Hi, everybody. I'm Wendy Murdoch, and this is Webinars with Wendy. I'm continuing this series of webinars, and we are lining up guests. We're in February. I'm like so confused date-wise. We're lining up guests for February. We've got some great guests coming along. So we were at Hoof Summit last week, and that was fantastic. We got to meet with lots of farriers, and there's a lot of farriers now using Surefoot pads. And so it's really great to watch these guys because we've been going for 4 years and they're all like, you know, serious, and they ignore us. And then they start to talk to us, and then they start to smile because we make their life easier, which is the whole point. So that was last week. This week, my guest is Jane Myers from the UK. She's going to talk about to us about aquaculture. So welcome, Jane. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me, Wendy. I'm really excited to be on your webinar. Yes, as I said earlier, I've followed you for quite some years now, unbeknownst to you. So, yes, I'm very aware of your work and love what you do.
Thank you so yes. much. So, Jane, tell us a little bit about you. Like, have you always been a horse lover, and how did you get into what you do?
Yes, I've been in horses all my life. And then just very briefly, as you can tell, I live in the UK by my accent and so on. And I'm obviously in the UK now. But we... when I was after university, where I studied the grazing behaviour of horses, we emigrated to Australia. So we spent 25 years there. So that was very interesting, enabled us to learn and be supported to do a lot of the things that we do now, because Australia actually is a bit backward in some areas, but in the area of sustainability and land management, it's actually very forward. So we used to get supported by the government over there. Then we've moved back over here for family reasons and so on. And we're not as supported, but we're still forging on. And we still have a lot of clients in Australia. We have a lot of clients in America as well and around the world following what we teach, which is about sustainability and horse keeping. And it's something we've been going on about for many years. And obviously, because of climate change now, everybody's starting to get really interested in this subject. So we're in the right place at the right time. But unfortunately, the reason people are loving what we do now is because of climate change. It's just a shame it has to be that way. But
I know. So you studied animal grazing as a degree?
Just equine grazing as a master's degree level.
Wow,
yes.
So I didn't know there was a degree that you could. That's awesome.
When you get to master's, you sort of choose your own research topic. So yeah, it was just on how horses graze. Yeah. So very, very specific. And then I wrote some books for the Australian government on land management. So all that information came in. So what's interesting, I guess, is that whereas most stuff you read about land management comes from agronomists and, you know, and often cattle people and so on, we've approached this subject from a horse behaviour point of view. So it's a very different way of looking at how you manage your horses and the land. And obviously it works much better because it's taking their behaviour into account. Whereas, you know, older ways of looking at land management didn't always, well, certainly for horses, didn't take their behaviour into account. So that's where this really gets people excited, is when they realise that it's looking at what the horse is. Because if you don't take their behaviour into account, they don't do it right. So you end up with all sorts of problems, which tonight in this very brief talk, I'll be going through some of, you know, how you can mitigate that.
Well, and so where were you in Australia?
Various places, just outside Melbourne originally, and then I ended up in Queensland. But for a while I worked for Melbourne University lecturing there, but in equine behaviour. And then after that, we started our own business, moved up to Queensland, which is in the north. And then eventually we were on the road full time, just getting paid by the government to teach horse owners how to keep soil on the land, because there's huge problems with soil runoff in all countries, but Australia in particular, because they're at a stage where in some areas they only have an inch, if they're lucky, of topsoil. So if, say, somebody buys 5 or 10 acres and doesn't actually know what they're doing, if they don't know what they're doing, sticks a few horses on there, within a couple of years they can have lost every little bit of topsoil they have, and that all ends up in the sea, on the Barrier Reef, and in important areas and so on. It all ends up out in the sea. Whereas if we catch them soon enough, we can not only teach them how to keep that soil, but to make more, through creating lots more organic matter.
Wow. And you know, I mean, I've lived in Australia for a year, a long time ago. So I was in Melbourne, Adelaide, Perth, Townsend. So lived around a bit. So what I want to say is that what it's like in the UK and what it's like in Australia are completely different climates.
They are, but what we teach applies just the same, whether it's too wet, too dry, or wherever we keep horses at any one time, it's always either too wet or too dry. It's hardly ever just right. You know, for a tiny bit of the year, it might be just right. The rest of the time, it's too wet or too dry. And what we teach works for the same. It's about holding your horses at the right times so that they can graze in the correct times. And then if you do that, you actually end up being able to extend that time that you can graze, because once you get that ground cover on the land, you can then graze longer into the dry times or longer into the wet times. Whereas if you're constantly overgrazing, the minute it rains, then your paddocks all just turn to mud. Your fields just turn to mud immediately. Whereas if you get that good dense sward happening, then even though it rains, you might be able to carry on turning your horses out for a while because there's enough vegetation there to actually hold the soil together. So that's one of the ways of looking at it. Yeah.
This is really interesting because here in Virginia, as you probably know, and especially given the winter we're having, we get mud season. And so, you know, you're especially, if you're limited on turnout and that sort of thing, your paddocks become muddy. My horses live up on the top of a hill, so we don't get the mud that some people get, but it's a problem. And you're absolutely right. The actual window of perfect grazing is small. And now with, you know, the extremes that we're having, like we had a really, really hot summer. And then of course a dry fall, we didn't get a lot of rain this fall. We were really getting concerned because it was so dry. And now of course we have snow and ice and freezing rain. Awesome. So I'm super excited. Let's go ahead and just dive right into your PowerPoint because I have a feeling you're going to learn an awful lot today.
Yes. And anything I don't cover tonight, we've got a pretty extensive website. I'm sure, Wendy, you'll be able to send people a link and all that sort of thing, so people can find out lots more. So don't worry because what we teach, there's a lot to it.
And in fact, if you just tell me your website right now, I'll pop it in the chat.
It's www.equiculture. So it's equiculture.net.
Got it. Okay.
So I'll have a go at sharing my screen now. I think do I just first of all, share screen. Yes.
Yeah.
That's it. And I'll just get rid of that. Hide video panel. I'm going to hide that. Sorry, it won't be a second. I'm just going to.
Okay.
I'll hide the flirting thing. Yes. And then slideshow.
Yep.
From beginning. Right. Okay. So you should be able to see that first slide there. Yes. Yeah. Okay. So I'll dive right in and get going. Okay. So first of all, just a little bit of background history. In the last 40 or 50 years in the Western world, the role of domestic horses has changed dramatically from predominantly a work animal to mainly a leisure animal. So horses now rarely work for a living. Some do, but not many compared to what they used to do. And the development of horsekeeping practices has progressed in a very ad hoc but human-focused fashion since domestication centuries ago. So the way we keep horses has not really taken into account their needs and behaviour. So it's not surprising that this has happened, because throughout history, horses have been kept as a resource or as a tool for war, agriculture, general transport, or in the past as a leisure activity for the wealthy. That's what they were for. So little thought's been put into how this affects the way that modern horses are managed. And the workload for horses, as I said, has reduced dramatically. Horses are now being confined into increasingly smaller areas as pressure for space grows. There's an increasing awareness of issues such as equine health, equine welfare, and combined with the growing concern for the environment, so the larger environment, has led to questions being asked about how and why we keep equines the way that we do. And these questions are going to start being asked more and more frequently by lay people, by people who don't actually understand horses. And in many ways, that's a good thing, because that's making us really question why we do things with our horses and why we do things the way we do. So the aquaculture ethos is horse ownership, responsible, sustainable, and ethical. With horse ownership comes a lot of responsibility, and we have a responsibility to manage our horses to the best of our ability and to do this sustainably and ethically. So first of all, we need to understand a little bit about what horses are. So they're a monogastric, that's a single stomach herbivore. So unlike many large grazing herbivores, such as sheep and cattle, they're ruminants. Horses graze and digest their food differently. And it's important we understand that, because a lot of the information that's out there just assumes that horses are really just like cows or sheep. So they have one stomach, they have one chance to digest that food, unlike ruminants that have several chances. They graze and digest at the same time. So as they're collecting their food, they're digesting it, because they don't lie down to ruminate like ruminant animals do. They have one chance and they have to digest their food literally while they're on the hoof. They eat more food, but it's less processed than it is in a ruminant animal. So they actually have to take in more food because they're not quite as efficient at digesting that food. And this means that their manure has more nutrients in it, which is a good thing if you're using that manure as a gardener or back on your land, which is actually something that we advocate when it's managed properly. So they evolved to eat low energy plants over a large range. So horses are basically a fiber processing animal, and naturally they seek out fiber over nutrition. So when horses graze, they're actually looking to eat more and more fiber rather than higher and higher nutrition food. They will go for that higher nutrition food if it's available, but they can survive on very low nutrition, but they need high fiber food, and that's what they're looking for all the time. And when they can't get it, that's what drives some of the seemingly weird behaviors that we see, like fence chewing bark on trees, even eating soil to some extent, digging up roots of plants, is that drive for fiber is so strong that's some of the things they will do if they need to get that fiber. So they live in what's termed a home range in the natural setting. And the reason this is important is because we need to understand that many other herbivores, like large grazing herbivores such as cattle and wildebeest, say in Africa and so on, what they do is they migrate across the continent. They might spend half the year moving across the continent, and the other half of the year moving all the way back again. They follow the grasses across the plains and they move back again. Horses don't do that. Horses in their natural situation actually live in what's called a home range. So that home range contains all of the resources they need. And when those resources are scarce, such as in the outback of Australia or in parts of the USA, that home range might be hundreds of square miles. Whereas where ponies live, say, in the UK as wild, like we do in the south of England, it might only be a few square miles, because that's all they need in order to survive. But that area will contain their water, their shade, shelter, and their feed. But what's good about understanding this, that means that when we keep horses in a domestic situation, we can actually replicate that on a much smaller scale, and I'm going to touch on how we can do that, without stressing them. Whereas if you think about it, if you're keeping a migratory animal in the domestic situation, straight away you're stopping them from traveling over those huge distances. Their inner clock, if you like, is telling them that they actually should be right now, they should be right on the other side of the continent. Whereas with horses, that doesn't happen. They live in a relatively small area, and that the size of that area is determined by the availability of the resources. So that's a good thing for us as horse owners and for them as domestic horses. As I said, it varies due to the availability. And we can use this instinctive behaviour to our and their advantage when we keep them domestically. So horses are also highly social herd animals. We must remember that a horse is a herd animal. Everybody knows this. Even people who don't know anything about horses know that horses live in herds. But a lot of people, especially horse people, don't acknowledge it. So they'll separate horses, keep them separate, because it suits them to do so, because it suits the owners to do them so. But generally speaking, unless a horse is very damaged, if you like. They thrive with other horses for security and companionship. It's very important in their management, and it actually makes it much easier to manage your land when you keep horses in herds rather than singly. And again, I'll be touching on this a bit more later. Just very briefly, domestic horses are part of the equine family, which also includes, it's a very small family compared to the ruminant families and camelid families and so on. This is it. This is all that is the equine family, zebra, Schwalbski horses, and mules, which are a hybrid between donkeys and horses usually. So you've got wild asses, which are donkeys as well, but they are a very small family. Many of the species, many of the parts of the equine family died out even before humans came along. So it's not all down to humans with horses. They just happened to die out. And the nearest cousins, interestingly, to horses are rhinoceros and tapir. Horses are nowhere near related to cows or sheep or anything like that. After these animals, the next animals they're related to are elephants, and then it's things like pigs and so on. So they're not related to cows at all. It's just that they happen to be a similar size and graze on grass. That's the only similarities they have, really.
This is an interesting little fact here. I didn't know that rhinoceros were close to horses.
Yeah, it's very interesting as well. And in Australia, when we lived there, they had an outbreak of the equine flu, which in Australia is not an endemic disease. So they were doing everything they could to get rid of it. What was interesting was the rhinoceros in the zoos, they were quarantining them because they weren't sure whether they could actually get the equine flu, because they're so closely related to horses that some of the diseases could possibly pass between them. So, yeah, very interesting.
Wow. Fascinating.
So there's many advantages and disadvantages to being a free living and a domestic living horse. Advantages and disadvantages both ways. So briefly, free living horses eat a very high fiber, low energy, low protein diet and graze for very long periods each day. Of all the grazing animals, horses have possibly one of the longest grazing periods, which I'll go into a bit more later on. Free living horses always live in herds and on the alert for much of the time, but this alert behavior is shared between the adult herd members so that individuals are not exhausted, because obviously they can't remain alert all the time. So they share that behavior between them. They travel many kilometers a day, miles, from feed and water and back again in, as I said, already said, in what's known as the home range. So they're always moving around, having a drink, going off then to graze and so on. And obviously, when the grass isn't growing very well, they've got to travel further to get to the feeding areas, but they keep returning to the same watering holes, unlike a migratory animal. Coping with a huge variety of climates, ranging from very cold right through to very hot. And this is one of the reasons that horses have managed to live in various climates of the world, even in areas they're not meant to be, such as Australia. They actually do really well. Is because they can actually cope with a very large range of temperatures. But the one that they really struggle with is very hot, humid weather, which you get in the northern parts of Australia, and obviously you get in certain parts of the USA. The reason that they don't do well in those climates is because horses, like us, and hardly any other animals, if any, rely on sweating to cool down. So we have that in common with horses, is that we sweat to cool down. And sweating doesn't work at all well when it's highly humid. Added to that, the larger a body is, the longer it takes to warm up, but the longer it takes to cool down. And then added to that, for horses, a high fiber food gives off more heat than low fiber food as it's being digested. So those three factors mean that in hot, humid weather, horses are even hotter than we are. So you need to be aware of that, that in that those sort of temperatures and high humidity, horses are a lot more uncomfortable even than we are, and it's bad enough for us. Yeah. So that's something to keep in mind. Just an interesting fact. Free-living horses don't tend to live as long as domestic horses, so they actually live as long as their teeth last. And that depends entirely on how fibrous the grasses are that they're eating. So in some cases, that might be 12 years. Sometimes, if they're lucky, it might be 20. Really depends entirely on the silica in the grasses. So as soon as their teeth have gone, that's the end of them, or if they're not caught by a predator before that. But in today's world, there's not many places, even where horses live wild, where there are actually many predators. So they tend to die because their teeth have worn out, basically.
And do you think this is the reason why horses are living so much longer? Because when I was absolutely a kid, 19 yes. was old.
they're living longer because they don't have, because we, once their teeth have gone, we can keep them going for many, many years after that. And so that's why they're living longer. And then that's why we're also seeing a lot of diseases that wouldn't be seen in the wild, because they would have died of old age long before that.
Got it.
Yeah. So free living horses have a low energy diet for much of the year. At the same time, they're constantly moving. They're coping with a range of temperatures. They're on the alert, reproducing. They're not wormed, rubbed, have dentistry or hoof care from humans. So you can see how their lifestyle is very different, and how they have all these, that takes a lot of energy to do all of that. So no matter how much they're eating, they're using all of that energy to just keep themselves alive. So domestic equines are managed by humans for better or for worse, and they have completely different stresses to their more natural living counterparts. Many don't receive adequate hoof or dental care, but obviously a lot do as well. But they don't get enough movement over a varied terrain. Most domestic horses are not using energy for reproduction, which is a good thing, because we have far too... Horses are one animal in the world that is in no danger whatsoever of becoming extinct. So, we actually have far too many horses in the world already. But what we need to keep in mind when we're feeding them is that if they're not reproducing, then they need even less energy than a wild horse would. They often receive too little exercise and too much high energy feed rather than lots of low energy, high fiber feed. We're always being pushed to feed our horses more through marketing. Feed your horses on this, that, and the other. And you must remember that feed companies don't sell hay and grass particularly. So they're not going to tell you that's all, for many horses, that's all they need, especially if they're not doing much at all. So because the feed companies sell bagged feed, then they're going to tell you that that's what your horse needs. But in many cases, horses don't actually need that. So domestic horses may be over-confined, and instead of having to find their own feed and water, it's literally given to them on a plate. So in a short space of time, relatively, horses have turned around from having to go and get their own food, having to work for a living and so on, to being brought to them. They're also often prevented from interacting with other horses, so therefore they develop stereotypic behaviours never seen in natural living horses. So there's no recorded cases of natural living, free living horses doing things like crib biting, obviously, because they're not in stables and so on. You just don't see those behaviors. Another factor as well to keep in mind is that the aggressive behavior we sometimes see in domestic horses is actually quite an unnatural behavior, because it happens for various reasons, such as separating horses when young means that they don't learn the correct social skills. So when we're introducing them, if we do decide to keep our horses as a herd, we need to be aware that it might take time for them to learn the social skills necessary for living with other horses in the domestic situation. So feeding times create competition. Remember that in the wild, feed is either everywhere or nowhere at any one time. It's not in feed buckets at certain times of the day. There's nothing to fight over in the wild situation, whereas in the domestic situation there is. So we need to be aware of that. So domestic horses can live a lot longer than wild horses. And this horse here is a really good example and a very, very unusual example. This horse lived to be 51 years old. He was a stallion. He was a warm blood cross, about 15-2. And he lived in a rescue centre. And what's quite amusing, he was handed into the rescue centre when he was in his 30s, probably not expected to live much longer, and yet he lived another 20 years. And I'm guessing that he would be the equivalent of a human making it to something like, 115 years old or something. Very, very unusual. But many horses now are regularly living to 35, 40 years old, especially ponies. So that's something we have to keep in mind as well, is that's a long time for them to live, and we need to be maybe rethinking about what we think of as an old horse, because if we think of a 20-year-old as old, in many cases that's only half the way through their lifespan. Really, they're only middle-aged, depending on how we take care of them. So horses used to be work animals. Now we do all the running around and physical hard work. And this change has come about very recently. So the horses stand around while we get the second or third job. And, you know, this is not necessarily what they would choose, but this is the way it's worked out. Things have changed rapidly. So looking at managing horses on the land, for certain things that it's really good if you can start to understand what's happening. So one of the things that's really important is as soon as we supplementary feed horses, and obviously in the domestic situation, we invariably at some point we're going to need to do that. But the minute we start to do that is the minute we start to change their behaviour. Because what happens is instead of them looking for their own feed, they then start looking for the feed to be brought to them. So that then leads to this behaviour of standing around at the paddock gate waiting for food to be brought to them. And sorry, when I say paddock, I mean field rather than a small yard or whatever. They start looking for food to come to them rather than going off and getting their own food. So think about cattle. They don't, unless they're milking cows, they don't stand around at the gate waiting to be let back in. They go off and graze because they don't tend to get bucket fed at the gate or brought into a stable or whatever, whereas horses, because they do, they actually start hanging around the gate. But once we understand that, again, it's something we can actually use to our and their advantage once we know how we can do that. So this is a very typical picture. This is a picture from Australia, but we've got three separated horses. The owners probably think they're doing the right thing in separating them. They probably think that it's great that the horses are getting to interact. Sorry, just getting a drink there, over the fence and gate. But in fact, separating in that way is very, very dangerous, because if those horses start playing, which often they will, in that situation, they can get serious fence injuries. But also look at the land and how, all that wear and tear that's happening because the horses are congregating there. And that can all disappear with the right management. And as I say, the danger of them hanging around the fence and gate as well. Interestingly, horse owners often think it's safer to separate horses, because yes, horses can injure each other, but fences statistically do far, far more damage to horses than other horses do to horses.
That is such a good point that people don't think about.
They never think about it. We all know horses who've either been, if you've been around horses a long time, either been killed by fences or totally maimed by fences. And horse owners would never say, so therefore we need to get rid of the fences. But when horses are put with other horses, and yes, sometimes you might get an injury, people never forget that, and then they will use that as a reason for separating their horses. When in fact, I would love somebody to do a study on this at some point, get some statistics on it, because I would bet that fences would have to be 10 times more dangerous than other horses are with horses. Because with horses, any experienced horse person knows it's just them getting to know each other that's the dangerous time. After that, doesn't tend to be much danger at all. And the reason you get that danger initially is because you've got all that suppressed behaviour. So when you put them together, of course they're going to go, silly. But when they live in a certain way where they're always together and there's always grass to eat and there's no reason to hang over the fences and so on, then all that behaviour disappears generally.
So that wouldn't be a difficult study, because all you have to do is go to the vets and ask them how many injuries are based on fencing installs versus.
That's right. It would be a good one for somebody doing a degree somewhere, definitely.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So this hanging around the gate waiting to be fed or taken to feed creates pressure on the land around the gateway or fence, causing erosion, dust and or mud. So that you'll see this in any horse paddock. And as horse owners, we tend to accept, well, that's what happens. And in Australia, you'll even see in certain soil conditions, the record I once saw, I think, on a very knowledgeable horse person's property was a 5-foot drop between the bottom of the gate and where the horse was standing at the gate, because the soil had worn away. There was this massive drop right behind, where the horse was standing. Then when it rained, obviously, the horses were just stood in a pool of water, so It's crazy, absolutely crazy. But as horse people, unless we're taught otherwise, we don't tend to think that there is a solution. As I said, when we understand this, we can use it to our advantage. Other things to keep in mind are that horses naturally dung in some areas and graze in others. So this is actually a natural behaviour, but when we keep them in a domestic situation, it becomes more concentrated. So that's why if you don't rotate your paddocks, meaning move them onto other paddocks, so horses, if horses are grazing continuously in the same areas, it will become very pronounced where you get these dung areas and these grazed areas. So that's the roughs and the lawns. And that means that, just say, for instance, you have a 5-acre horse property, straight away you lose 1 or 2 acres for the infrastructure on that property, the house and the garden and any buildings you might have. So you might be lucky if you've got about 3 acres grazing, but this behaviour can actually mean that in a few years you will actually only have 50% of that grazing available to the horses. So you don't even have 3 acres, you have 1.5 acres out of a 5-acre property. And again, with the right management, that can be completely turned around, because what you want to be doing is getting as much production out of that land as possible. Whereas, you know, keeping your horses in this way, letting that behaviour happen, just means that you'll have less and less grass over time. So it leads to an imbalance of nutrients, because what's happening is they're constantly taking from the lawns and depositing via their manure in the roughs. So you end up with this big imbalance of nutrients, and each year you get less and less grazing, and it's termed horse sick. It doesn't, I mean, yes, the paddock is sick, but that's just an old-fashioned terminology, certainly here in the UK anyway. Just means it's a horse-sick paddock. That's what it's always been called. So when we separate horses, we get these kind of issues. So walking the fence line, as I've said before, it creates fence injuries, creates bare, compacted areas which become a channel for water. So if it's on a slope, that area where the horses walk will become an erosion channel. In some areas, in some soil conditions, what that walking up down the fence line will do is actually undermine the fence line. So eventually that fence will just fall over. So if that path becomes deep enough, because it's right up to the fence, you will actually lose all that very expensive fencing. In fact, that picture there in the top left corner was taken at the Kentucky Horse Park from memory. When we went there a few years ago. So that's very, very expensive fencing, and through bad land management is being completely undermined. So fence walking causes serious and extensive damage to your land. It's either a sign of stress, of either current or historic stress, because if horses are separated, they will just do it as a stereotypic behaviour. It's the same behaviour seen in stressed caged zoo animals. So if they were to go to a zoo and see things like polar bears walking backwards and forwards, they say, oh heck, that's awful, that animal is stressed, they'll recognize that. But with horses, it's often not recognized as such. It's even sometimes seen as naughty, bad behavior, yet that animal is carrying out exactly the same stress response as any caged animal. The reason that horses walk the fence lines is because they're trying to get to other horses. The picture in the top left corner there was caused in one afternoon. Again, that picture in the top left is in Australia in sandy soil conditions. That was just a horse literally galloping up and down a fence line in a really, really distraught fashion, caused that damage in just one afternoon. So that's how quickly it can happen in certain conditions. So we need to remember, with horses, they have 2 sets of incisors and they are able to eat literally right down to the ground. It's almost like having a pair of scissors in their mouth. They're so efficient at grazing extremely short grass. And they also, as well as that, have a mobile top lip, which allows them to be very selective. And also, horses are said to have 5 sets of teeth, meaning that every hoof, especially once the plants have worn out, is doing almost as much damage as their mouth. So when you're grazing a horse, when it gets to this stage where you're trying to graze a horse on overgrazed land, every step they take is actually doing damage and making it so that it will take longer for that area of land to recover when the conditions improve again. So horses are highly efficient, but this with the wrong management results in less and less grass over time, because they didn't evolve to be kept in one tiny place without the land ever getting a chance to rest and recuperate, because in their natural environment, they would have a larger area. And so they would move around the land, their home, they'd move around their home range, but they would, certain areas would get time to rest and recuperate before the horses came back to them. So when we keep horses in a domestic situation, there actually has to be a compromise. Now, we cannot compromise the environment, because that's what we've been doing, and that's why we're in this mess that we're in now on a micro and a macro scale. We've been doing that for far too long. The compromise has to actually be, believe it or not, to the horses themselves. But when we understand how to do that, we can do that without stressing them at all. In fact, we can usually vastly improve their living conditions and compromise them at the same time. And I'll explain that a bit more as we go along. After we'd been in Australia for many years and we came back here, so I'll just take a quick drink. We were absolutely astonished to find that horses, in the 25 years we'd been away, had gone from being seen as bad for the land to actually being used to recreate biodiverse grazing. And the term for it is conservation grazing. There's various terms for it, but rewilding actually is the most common in vogue term at the moment, is rewilding land. So what they're doing all over Europe now is using horses combined with cattle to recreate biodiverse grasslands. Because what happens is that the two of them combined create the right conditions then for lots of other species of wildlife to come in. So in the UK, that tends to be a lot of bird life. And at the same time, there's a lot of ground nesting birds and lots of insect, bees, pollinators, all that sort of thing. But they're using horses combined with cattle to do that. So that blew us away that was happening. And since coming back, we've looked at this quite a lot. There's some really, really interesting projects going on in the whole of Europe using horses for rewilding. And in this group here, there's approximately 50 horses. There's actually several little herons, if you like, several stallions with their groups of mares. So certain times of the day, they all quite happily come together. And then certain times of the day, they all move apart. If anybody ever gets over to the UK and they want to see some of these interesting projects, just email me and I can point you in the direction of some really interesting things to go and have a look at. So when we were studying some of these groups, so like this group here, it's just fascinating to see the amount of behaviour that's going on. Because this behaviour that you would hardly see in domestic horses because they're just suppressed from carrying out all this behaviour. So the... yeah, there's a lot going on. Even, every minute of the day, there's something going on, and it's fascinating to watch them. So why is land management so important for your horse or horses? So by creating a healthy grazing environment, you create healthy, happy horses. So we need to aim to maximise the time your horse spends grazing healthy pasture. And that might mean initially herding your horses, and letting the pasture get in front of the horses. Because what tends to happen on most horse properties is the pasture is always several steps behind the horses, trying to catch up, and it can't because it's under too much pressure. Many horse owners are trying out different ways to manage their horses and their weight, because this is another big issue, obviously, with domestic horses, is managing their weight, because they're not usually doing enough to burn off the energy that they're taking in. And a lot of ways that we're doing this is based on some kind of restrictive feeding and grazing practices, which we're not keen on, because it has negative impacts on the health of the land, which in turn affects the health of your soil. So deliberately overgrazing an area, whether that be in a track around your land or in just one paddock or whatever, is not really, it's just not sustainable, because what it's doing is just losing topsoil at a huge amount, creating all sorts of problems, as you can see in this picture here, creating lots of weeds, lots of mud, lots of dust. So when it's dry, you'll have lots of dust. When it's wet, you'll have lots of mud, and it's not sustainable. So poor management stresses the grass, the soil, and the horse's metabolic system. So again, this is in Australia, typical paddock where it's grazed to death before the horses are turned on to the next area. And all it's doing is meaning that they're losing every year more and more soil. Also, the horses are eating a lot of soil as they go. Whereas healthy pasture and healthy soil work together. You can't have one without the other. So what we're trying to demonstrate in this picture is the longer the grass is, the longer the plants are, the longer the root systems are, which is a really interesting thing. So if you only ever have really short grass, you only ever have really short root systems. Longer root systems go deeper down into the soil, and most importantly of all, longer root systems sequester more carbon, lots and lots of carbon. Grazing animals are actually one of the best tools we have for climate change. It's just starting, well, a lot of people have known this for quite a while, but it's starting to become more common knowledge. Trees are fantastic for sequestering carbon, but it takes them many years to get to the stage where they do that. Pasture sequesters carbon really quickly. So continuously grazing your pasture, the roots grow long and deep, and then as the pastures grow short, the roots die back but leave lots of carbon in the soil. Then they grow again. They are virtually pumping carbon down into the soil. That's what grazing animals do, and this is where these large grazing herbivores are so important for climate change. And I've just written an article on that on our website, so make sure you have a look at that if you're interested in learning more about that. So time budgets and social behaviours in horses. Very quickly, we need to just look at what horses do with their day. So first of all, grazing. Horses graze between 12 and 15 hours a day. You'll often see it written that they graze for 18 or 20 hours a day, but they don't actually, because they have to have time for those other behaviours as well. They will only extend their grazing time out to 20 hours a day in extreme bad conditions, so when it's extreme drought, winter or whatever, and they won't actually be grazing at that stage because there won't be anything to graze really. They will just be looking for food. So normally if a horse has decent grazing available to it, it will spend between 12 and 15 hours a day. But that also means if you have grazing that's really, really rich pasture and the horse is not really doing much else, they will still graze between 12 and 15 hours a day and will end up overeating. So that's something to keep in mind. Grazing is the most natural way for your horse to feed itself. Millions of years of evolution have created this harmonious symbiotic relationship between grazing animals, such as your horse, and plants. Horses spend, as I said, a minimum of 12 hours grazing and a maximum of 20. This is an interesting one, that a grazing bout, so that means when a horse starts to graze, so he's been doing something else like lying down, having a drink, having a snooze, whatever. When he starts a grazing bout, it's called in scientific terms, that will last between 1.5 to 3 hours. And the horse stops grazing when the fibre content in the stomach indicates that the stomach is full. So they're constantly eating to fill up and maintain a high gut fill level. Now, the interesting thing is, and hopefully, there'll be more research about this as well, is if a horse is eating low fibre food, they don't get that indication that they've eaten enough fibre. They keep eating and they eat too much. The more fibrous the grasses are, the quicker they get to that point and they actually stop eating. So that's something to keep in mind. Fibre is often sort of a nutritional value. So it's fibre that keeps the horse's digestive system working. Horses know that they need fibre constantly going through their gut in order to keep them safe and healthy. So they're always looking for fibre. Grazing, this is another really interesting one. Grazing is linked to walking. So the horse's whole physiology has evolved to enable this to happen efficiently. So if horses walk at 1 kilometre an hour, so that's 0.6 of a mile, and they graze for approximately 12 hours a day, they will have walked around 7 or 8 miles that day of slow, steady exercise. So the more horses graze, the more they walk. Conversely, if you turn a horse out into an area that doesn't have any grass, so I'll go back to that. If you don't turn them out into somewhere that's bare, they don't say to themselves, right, I know there's nothing to eat, but I need to keep fit, so I'll get walking anyway. They just don't do that. They might bum around for the first 5 or 10 minutes that you turn them out, but as soon as they've run off that excess energy, they will then switch to just standing still. So people often turn horses out onto degraded land thinking, well, at least the horse is getting some exercise, but they're not. Because horses only move because they have to, because the grasses don't come to them, they have to go to the grasses. So the more biodiverse the pasture is, the more they move around it, looking for those different plants. This is where biodiversity is one of the reasons it's so important for your horse's health, is because it keeps them moving. They will not move without it. So grazing is the activity that takes up most of their time, or should be, and yet often little thought is given other than about them gaining weight. There's strong evidence to suggest that over time, by increasing the health of your soil and therefore the grasses, most horses will get to the point where they will learn to self-regulate when they, and they can be returned to healthy pasture. Now, there is this really tricky stage to get through with a lot of horses, because if you think about it, what we've done is, historically, we've tended to create, you could say, eating disorders in our domestic horses. We've micromanaged how they eat, when they eat, how much they eat, measuring it all out and all that sort of thing. So when we turn them out, especially if it's onto long grass or a lot of grass, they are going to gorge themselves. So you've got to get them through that stage. And again, this is what we go into a lot in our books and on our course, is how to get them through that. Because as long as the horse is, you know, relatively otherwise healthy, you should be able to get them to the stage where they can graze safely, because they're not thinking that the grass is going to be run out and be taken away from them all the time. That's what we need to get, the stage we need to get them to, and then they can graze quite safely. So the other behaviour that horses carry out, obviously, is sleeping. Now, I'm going to run through that one really quickly. Horses sleep for about a total of about 4 hours a day. But very important in horses, a lot less than we sleep, but just as important. And their sleeping tends to be in 15-minute bouts. So it's not for very long. There's various reasons for that. One, that they're predated on by predators. And then the other is that when they lay flat out on their side, which is the only position where they thought to be able to get REM sleep, it's very hard to breathe because of the weight on their lungs. So they only do it in very short periods. Interestingly, there's some research supposedly going on at the moment, I think, into horses and sleep, because it's an area that's not been very well researched in the past. The other area that we need to be aware of is loafing behaviour. So this is the term for everything else that horses do with their day. So it's when they're just standing around together, swishing flies out of each other's face, grooming each other, lying down, just snoozing or whatever, well, another part of sleep. But playing is another big one, just being together, but not actually grazing. So that tends to take up, again, around 4 hours a day. Very important behaviour in horses. A healthy horse will still play right into old age, especially male horses, where cattle don't, for instance. Think about, you know, cows don't play the same. There's many reasons for that. But horses do play, run around, if they're healthy, right into old age. So this loafing behaviour, as much as possible, we need to try and encourage them to carry that out on surfaced areas to reduce pressure on the pasture. Because unless you have a lot of pasture, that creates a lot of wear and tear on the land. So again, I'll be talking a little bit at the end about how we can do that. We also need to consider what's become known as the 3Fs, a concept by Lauren Fraser in Canada. So basically, it's a way of condensing how we think of what horses really need. Basically, friendship, forage, and freedom. So friendship, remembering that horses are herd animals, they need interaction with other horses for skin care, support, stimulation, education, and so on. Forage, horses need... they're basically a fibre processing animal. They need a high fibre diet. And freedom, they need freedom to move, but also to choose. Because the way that we keep horses in the domestic situation, we pretty much take their choices away from them. And some horses, especially competition horses, every step they take every day is dictated by a human. Whereas if we can turn that around and give our domestic horses choice about moving where they want to be and when, we're giving them back something really, really powerful. And again, we can show you how we can do that. So is there a better way to keep horses? We think there is. Is there an easy to manage system? And in a way that also at the same time reduces your workload and is good for the environment. So what we advocate people do is by creating a mini home range for your horses, With all of their resources readily available, their food, water, shelter, companionship, and allowing them choice. So where they can voluntarily take themselves away from the grazing areas, reducing pressure, increasing movement. And we developed this idea many years ago when we lived in Australia, and we called it the equicentral system. And it basically combines all of these things that I've been very briefly been talking about. So it combines their natural behavior, good land management by using rotational grazing, and it creates a healthy and sustainable environment for your horses, your land, and the wider environment. So the way it works really, really briefly is just say this is a typical horse property. You might have a riding area, which if you want to, can also be used as your loafing yard. Some people want to do that, some people don't. Some people would create another area, but it's important that you have an area of hard standing of some kind, somewhere that the horses can get to when it's too wet or too dry to graze. And that area is where you feed all the hay, it's where the water is kept, you no longer have the water in the fields or the paddocks, and where there's shade and shelter. So what happens is, in this picture here, the horses are grazing that one paddock at a time because you're rotationally grazing. They go out for a grazing bout in the morning, say. Then after about an hour and a half, 3 hours, they bring themselves back because they now want to drink. And then they will tend to voluntarily hang on that surfaced area for a few hours, just loafing. You will be absolutely amazed how many horse owners get in touch with us and say, I really didn't think my horses would do this, but it's like they've read the book because they do exactly what we said they would do, which is where they come back to where the shade and shelter is, where the water is, and any supplementary feed. Then they take themselves back out for another grazing bout, say in the afternoon. If the grazing conditions are right, they can be doing that night and day. If they're not, they could be doing it through the day, and then you could have them on the yard overnight and feed them supplementary feed as well as hay if you wanted to. It all depends on their needs and on the, but most importantly, on the land. In this system, they are never fastened in a paddock, but they might sometimes be fastened on the hard standing area, depending on conditions, but they're never fastened out of the hard standing area. So therefore those bare areas in the gateways just disappear. So these are the advantages of keeping horses in this way. I've only really quickly moved through it, but horses have to move more. So every time they want a drink, they have to walk to where the water is like they would in the wild. It saves the cost of individual shelters and water troughs in paddocks. You have one set of facilities that are used every day of the year. It vastly reduces the grazing pressure on the land without stressing the horses. In fact, it's not stressing them at all. It's quite the opposite, because they're doing what they would do in the wild, moving out to the grazing areas, but moving back to the water. Because what you've done is you've created this mini home range. The horses take themselves in and out. It saves you having to lead them in and out all the time. Any hay that you do feed is fed on the surface, which is a better idea than feeding it on your grass, depending on where that hay has come from. You're not having to cart feed around the property. Again, they're coming to you for it. Less manure is dropped out on the land. So if you're collecting manure, it's much easier to collect. No horses standing around a gateway. So you end up, muddy gateways become a thing of the past because the gate is never shut on that side, keeping them in the paddock. So it negates the problem of where to put the water if you're strip grazing. That's just a small point. But horses don't have to stand around in muddy conditions, developing skin conditions such as greasy heel, mud fever, it's called in the UK and Australia. But from a behavioural point of view, one of the biggest pluses of keeping horses in this way is that horses are now able to decide as a group where they want to be and are able to take themselves there. And this is a huge deal for domestic horses. Suddenly, we're giving them choice and letting them actually decide when they want to stand in the shade, rather than putting them out, you know, before we go to work in the morning and saying, you're going to stay there now until I come back from work or whatever, whether the horse wants to or not, they just have to be there. Instead, the horses can come and go all day if they want. And that is exactly what they do when we give them choice. And at the same time, they're improving the land. So it just works so well. As I said, you're creating a home range for your horses with all their resources freely available. Okay, so in a nutshell, that's it. I'll end the show and come back.
So essentially, if I understand correctly, what you're saying is that if you don't have a place, build a loafing area.
Yes.
That's basically dry. It's where you, like, I'm thinking about my property where my horses are. We have an area that's got bluestone. It's a dry area. And there's a shed and there's water. And those three are not exactly in one spot, but they're in the closest proximity. And then there's pasture and there's a second field. But by kind of figuring out how to put that more concisely, I'll have to think about, then have that where that's where they go in and out. They'll come back, they'll rest, they'll eat, they'll sleep there, but then they'll wander out and graze and then come back again. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. And a lot of horses
share your screen, then we can just, we'll see you larger.
Sorry?
Yep.
Yeah, so a lot of horse properties already have the right things they can use to do this. They just never thought of using it in that way. So lots of horse properties, lots of horse properties already have hard standing around, you know, some buildings or whatever. They just never thought to use it that way. And other horse, so just typically in the UK, for example, a lot of people have, you know, like a U-shaped stable yard, with hard standing in the middle. And what some people do when they start thinking this way is they might actually, it sounds a bit drastic, but they might even take the fronts off of all the stables and make it just one big running shed. And the central area, which before was you know, only used for leading horses across, becomes the loafing area with the shelter all around the outside. You might still leave a couple of places with, you know, the fronts on or whatever, because it's always handy to have some stables. But also another way of looking at it, a lot of people, what they might do is instead put swing away partitions so that buildings can be stable sometimes, and then the gate can be swung open and the whole thing made open sometimes. You know, the more flexible you can make it, the better.
Right.
And if you're building from scratch, it's easy to do that.
Sure.
If you've already got an established, you know, if you've already got something up, sometimes it takes a bit of working around, but it's usually not too difficult if you have some infrastructure already to change it around and make it more horse friendly.
Right. And so, you know, we've kind of thought of this, the one area where we have the bluestone and the water in the shed, it's sort of in a line. And
yeah,
I've used electric fence to kind of make it so if I need to close it off, I can. If I need to keep the horses off the pasture, I can. And then open it. And I've been kind of playing with using electric fence to get them to move more around the pasture. But it sounds like I need to just go back and think about how to make that space a little more isolated, not isolated so much, but a little more concise.
Yeah, yeah.
So that they'll go out and in.
That's right. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Because what basically your attitude needs to become, unless your head's down grazing, you should be off the land. You know, because what you need to eliminate is any hanging around on the land. If you're going to do any hanging around, just standing there, you want them to do that on your surfaced area and not on the land.
Yeah, because this is what I was noticing recently, is they were all hanging out on the paddock instead of coming back to the loafing area. So I suppose it requires a little bit of incentive, something that's going to draw them back to get, because they're
Make sure that that's where all the good stuff is. Like any supplementary feed that they ever get should be on the surfaced area. That should be where the water is. That's where the shade and shelter and any hay is. And you, most cases, unless they really don't like the surfaced area for some reason, you like it somewhere with a lot of noise or whatever, they will voluntarily take themselves to that surfaced area.
Cool. So we have a question. We almost have this where I board my horse, but with no grazing during the winter months. Yeah. He needs the hay available in the grazing area and the loafing area. And so, right now we had this horrendous snow with ice and. So what do we do in those times?
Well, it's interesting actually, because in some conditions, in really wintry conditions, you can actually turn horses out when there's a lot of snow, if it's safe to do so,
because
they're not actually doing that much damage if there's enough, you know, snow on the ground and so on. So you don't necessarily have to keep them off the land all of the time. If they're not, basically, you just to learn about when they're doing damage and when they're not. So if you can turn them out on a snowy paddock, that's fine if they're not actually doing it any damage. Because another way of looking at it is if you throw hay out there, they're actually trampling those seeds in to the snow and so on. And then eventually those seeds will get into the soil as well. So that can work. You know, in some climates, it's actually a good thing for them to be out. So as long as it's not wet snow and as long as it's not icy, slippy snow, they can actually, no problem with them going out. Another way of looking at it is in the drought conditions in Australia, one of the things we used to talk about is in, you can select one paddock at a time and actually deliberately feed your hay out in that paddock and actually let them, because what happens is all, especially if they're feeding on really big round bales, all of that that's left is just trampled onto the ground and becomes incredible mulch. And as long as you get the horses off there once they've done that, you will get grass growing there where before there was nothing growing, you know, so you can actually use the horses. In fact, we've got a video again on our website about mulching. People love that, absolutely love the video.
You know, you usually think of when they grind their hay into the ground, that's a bad thing, but it sounds like it could be
a really good thing. It's a really good thing, especially if, but what you have to do is once they've done it, you have to remove the horses and take them somewhere else, because once it's been trampled in, then it has to go through a period of regenerating.
Right.
And this is the thing that most horses have the problem with, is when to take the, when to hold their horses.
Right.
They have to actually get them off there, allow the land to recover, because once you get the land so that it's recovered and it's in front of the horses, you will be able, those horses will be grazed, be able to graze for a much larger period of time throughout the year, whether it's too wet or too dry. So in a drought situation, if you've got more organic matter on your land, it will take longer to get to that point where you have to stop grazing. And in wet conditions, it will take longer to get to that point where you've got to get them off the land. So even though you might have to hold your horses a bit more than you like initially, in time, you will hold your horses far less than your neighbor who's not doing this would have to.
Right. I mean, there's a certain amount of, you have to repair damage before it's going to work for you.
Absolutely.
So, yeah. So what about, this is something when I was listening to your talk, the length of grass. In other words, you know, do we mow our paddocks? Don't we mow our paddocks?
Yeah. If you're grazing rotationally, and if you only have horses, you will tend to need to mow occasionally, because horses will do that where there's some areas that they won't graze, some that they will. So those areas, when you move the horses onto the next paddock, it's a good idea to go in and top any bits that they've left, and then it will all go back up at the same rate again. If you have different grazing animals that follow the horses or go in front of the horses, there's advantages and disadvantages both ways. You don't usually have to mow, because those other animals will eat the grasses that the horses won't, and vice versa. If you have other grazing animals, you might not have to mow at all. But basically, a mowing machine really is only copying what grazing animals do. So that's all a mowing machine does. In fact, if you think of all the machinery we have, all of it, including harrows, those things that break manure up, all they're doing is when grazing animals move across a landscape, their hooves break the manure up. Pasture harrows do the same thing. Every machine we have just aims to copy what grazing animals would do in the wild. So a mowing machine is just like a herd of sheep going through.
Right.
So if you've got sheep, you don't need to.
Yeah. No, I'm just thinking, you know, because we have weed cycles here in Virginia. Like they come up at a certain time, and of course the horses won't touch those. So we go in and we top off the weeds to keep them under control, so the grasses will grow. And so it's good to hear that mowing is good. And then it's just a question of kind of, so when you talk about rotational grazing, then actually having different pastures where the horses can have access to get back to the loafing areas, so you can rest certain areas.
Yes. So you're aiming to only have one paddock in pasture in use at any one time, if possible. So the horses are in that one area and all the rest of the land is resting and recuperating, rather than having all of the land, which is what's typically done on a lot of horse properties, all of the land in use all of the time.
Right.
And what's happening is everywhere is getting stressed at a low level, but continuously, pasture grasses thrive on being stressed but short, sharp periods and then left for as long as possible to rest and recuperate. That's what happens in the wild. So in the domestic situation, rotational grazing is the nearest we can come to copying that, what's going on in the wild. That's what grasses have thrived to have, is animals grazing them but then leaving them for a period to rest and recuperate.
Right.
And that's what rotational grazing does. Yeah.
Cool. All right. Let's see. And interestingly, the hay can't go into frozen ground. Horses are taken in the dry lot loafing area once. Okay. Allowing the hay seeds. All right. So this is Katie. This is amazing. My whole herd stays on my pasture for the winter after there is a good snow cover. When it starts to melt in the spring, we take them off, clean up the poop piles and repair the ground. Then don't have to go back until the grass is at least 4 inches and the weather is warmer and above 4 degrees C at night. So, so it really comes down to taking a look at what your pasture situation is, looking at where your loafing area is and hoping it's as central as possible to these different grazing zones.
Yeah. And you might need lane ways to get them to pasture. It all depends on, every property is different. So you might just need different configurations to get them to those grazing areas. Yeah. Right. Might need
this is super informative and just an excellent, excellent webinar. I really appreciate this, Jane.
You're welcome.
Because, there's a lot in here and there's right now we're dealing with a situation where we've got the frozen snow and the ice and the mud and everything was like rocks. And so, they're in that loafing area and you just have to accept that there's going to be some cleanup needed to come warmer weather. But the idea of then working so that I can reorganize my pastures and I've been sort of on this path, but not quite. I can see where I can make some great changes and to make some great improvements. And this is fantastic. And they're going to head over to your website and keep learning. So,
Can I just add that it's about, as horse owners, we're generally very good at learning to look at our horses and say, oh, he's lost a bit of weight. Oh, no, he's put a bit of weight on. We need to do things. But we need to learn to do that same level of learning and looking and caring about the land and think of if we get the land right, that will look after our horses. Whereas as horse owners, we tend to focus just on the horse. And the land is just somewhere to turn the horses out for a bit of grazing, a bit of play or whatever. We've got to turn that around completely, get the land right, that will look after the horses. And that's, that's ethos for everything really, isn't it? We haven't been, as humans, we haven't been doing that. And we need to be doing that, looking after the land so that it can look after us all.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Well, Jane, I want to thank you so much for joining me today. This has been fantastic.
Welcome.
Really informative. I've learned a lot. And thank you everybody for joining us. Just remember you can find this and all the other webinars on the Surefoot Equine YouTube.
Yeah, there's lots of good videos on the website and join us
on your Facebook. Website.
Yeah. Brilliant. Okay. Awesome.
All right. Thanks everybody. Have a great day.
Thank you. Bye.